It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Is there an economic price that can coerce geopolitical behavior? It's a question politicians have been wrestling with practically since there were politicians. President Bush tried his hand today in Sudan again. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. Angie'sList.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today's Tuesday, May 29th. Good to have you with us. Today, President Bush directed the Treasury Department to tighten the already existing economic sanctions against Sudan. 30 companies owned or controlled by the government in Khartoum will be barred from doing business with the U.S. financial system. But it's already a crime for American companies or financial institutions to do business with Sudan. So we asked Marketplace's Jeff Tyler what's new this time.
162 Sudanese companies have now been barred from doing business with the U.S. American officials believe some of those firms are trying to circumvent the sanctions through the use of front companies or third country intermediaries. Adam Zubin is with the Treasury Department.
We know that the government of Sudan continues to seek to access the U.S. financial system and the U.S. dollar to process large trade transactions, most notably its oil transactions.
But many observers say the new measures are mostly symbolic. Sebastian Malaby with the Council on Foreign Relations says Sudan is already commercially isolated.
Even if these new sanctions do constitute in some marginal way a ratcheting up of that isolation, I don't think it's going to make a big difference.
In fact, Malaby says the Sudanese likely feel less pressure today than they did 3 years ago. That's because Sudan has been repeatedly threatened with economic sanctions and military action, but the international community has failed to follow through. If we really want to pressure Sudan, Malaby says, we should be putting pressure on its largest trade partner, China.
In 1 year's time, we're going to have the Beijing Olympics. And when the world's eye is on China, China does not want to be profiled as a major league supporter of genocide and human rights abuser.
China's assistance is necessary in order to pass a proposed new United Nations Security Council resolution. Again, Adam Zubin with the Treasury Department.
As important as the U.S. financial system is, to the extent that the U.N. can impose stricter sanctions on the government of Sudan, that, of course, has an exponentially greater impact.
But don't hold your breath waiting for China to cooperate. Today, a Chinese spokesman defended his country's financial ties to Sudan, saying that rather than sanctions, investment is the best way to stop the bloodshed in Darfur. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Say you've been working for the same company for years. One day you find out you've been discriminated against. Your colleagues were being paid a lot more than you were for all of those years. So you sue. Today, the Supreme Court kept an eye on the clock and the calendar. The justices ruled that if you waited too long to bring your lawsuit, you're out of luck. Nancy Marshall Genzer reports now from Washington.
Lily Ledbetter worked for Goodyear for 19 years. During all that time, she was paid $6,000 a year less than the lowest paid man doing the same work. Ledbetter sued. Her case went all the way to the Supreme Court. Today, the court ruled that workers like Ledbetter only have 6 months from when they were first discriminated against to file a lawsuit. The ruling means Ledbetter will only get 6 months of back pay, not the 19 years' worth she wanted. Karen Harnett of the National Federation of Independent Business says it's hard for companies to fight lawsuits focusing on decisions they made years ago.
They cannot have the threat of a suit looming years after the fact, in which memories have to be tapped, and it's just very hard, truthfully, to get at the truth decades after.
But workers may not realize right away that they're being discriminated against. How many of us actually know what the person working next to us is making? Kate Bronfenbrenner teaches industrial labor relations at Cornell.
To figure out whether you're discriminated against, you have to have information. You have to do research. You can't do that quickly.
Some economists say there are workers who do need more time. Gary Chasen is with Clark University.
If there are extenuating circumstances, for instance, the person may have been aware that there was pay discrimination but declined to say anything about it for fear that they would be denied future promotions or opportunities for training.
Chasen says, for starters, Congress should update laws written decades ago. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
It's not quite a glut, but there's about to be more gas coming to market. Five big refineries in Texas, Louisiana, and Delaware came back online today. That should ease some of the squeeze motorists have been feeling at the pumps. And in fact, crude dumped more than $2 today, down about 3% to $63.15 a barrel in New York. You're going to want to get the spelling right on the name of the guy in this next story. It's Zoellick. There's an anonymous word this afternoon from a senior administration official that Robert Zoellick will be nominated to be the new president of the World Bank tomorrow by President Bush. Marketplace's Hillary Wickay, that's WICAI, reports.
Robert Zoellick was a one-time U.S. trade representative and the former number two official at the State Department. He will replace Paul Wolfowitz, who steps down as World Bank president at the end of June. That follows an ethics scandal involving securing a new job and a pay raise for Wolfowitz's girlfriend. Zoellick is known for his high-level contacts with Europe, China, Latin America, and Africa. He built a strong reputation with developing countries as the lead U.S. trade negotiator. He's also known for his involvement in the reunification of Germany. He quit the State Department last summer after he was passed over for Treasury Secretary. The selection of Zoellick is already getting a positive reaction from other countries, and the White House expects him to be accepted by the World Bank Executive Board. The president is expected to announce his decision about the new World Bank head tomorrow. In Washington, I'm Hillary Wickay for Marketplace.
Moving on now, it's not only China. The American cattle industry has had its own share of trouble with food safety lately. Some countries banned beef from the U.S. for a while over some isolated cases of mad cow disease. Cattle growers and meat packers took a painful hit. Some are still struggling to recover. But today, Latin America's largest meat producer gave U.S. meat packers a $225 million vote of confidence. A Brazilian firm is going to buy this country's third biggest processor, Swift & Company. Marketplace's Bob Moon has more.
If antitrust regulators go along, the takeover of Swift by Sao Paulo-based JBS will create the world's largest beef and pork processing company. Brazil is already the world's biggest exporter of beef, but it's had trouble making inroads into the North American and Asian markets because of food safety concerns, primarily from hoof and mouth disease. D.C.-based trade analyst Gary Huffbauer at the Institute for International Economics says the acquisition could open some important doors for the Brazilians.
This firm would clearly have to meet U.S. standards, but operating on a very big scale in the U.S., it would get to know better the standards and be able to integrate them backwards to the big livestock sources within Brazil. So I think they see it as a kind of a technology learning process.
Swift also operates out of Australia, giving the Brazilian company a key jumping-off point for exports to Asia. U.S. cattle producers might be worried, but Huffbauer says the Brazilian company has a clear interest in building up Swift's American operations. At the agriculture research firm DTN, veteran livestock analyst John Harrington agrees that in the end, the acquisition should benefit the entire industry.
That we'll have more buyers for U.S. cattle, and I think it's actually good news for U.S. producers.
Swift's operations could use some beefing up. It's posted just a single profitable quarter since November of 2004, when the scare over mad cow disease caused exports to collapse, and Swift is handing over more than $1 billion in debt to its Brazilian buyer. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Everybody and their grandmother seems to want a piece of ABN AMRO, and they're willing to pay a pretty penny to get it. Today, the Royal Bank of Scotland made an official offer of $95 billion for the Dutch bank. It's trying to beat out Barclays. They're based in the UK. One might have expected more from investors who were coming off a nice, relaxing three-day break, what with falling oil prices and those deals I mentioned. And there were gains on Wall Street today, but nothing to write home about. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you had any doubts at all that healthcare wasn't going to be an 08 election issue, get rid of them right now. Barack Obama laid out his healthcare proposal today in Iowa. Every citizen would get some kind of coverage. Most, he promised, would save up to $2,500 a year. Senator Clinton talked about her healthcare plan last week, similar in many ways to Obama's. John Edwards gave us his prescription earlier this year, all of them driven by this fact of early 21st century American life.
The bottom third of the income distribution is being systematically priced out of healthcare.
Uwe Reinhardt's a professor of economics at Princeton University. We called him up to talk about the various proposals floating around out there. Professor, welcome to the program.
My pleasure.
So here we have, as of today, sir, three of the leading Democratic candidates with plans out, Senator Edwards, Senator Clinton, and now Senator Obama. Is there anything in each of these plans that stands out at you that makes you say, oh, now there's an innovation, there's something that might really finally break this open?
Well, on the Edwards plan, what stands out is that he actually put money on the table. As I recall, it was something he's willing to spend $120 billion a year, which is almost as much as we spend in Iraq. And the other two candidates don't have any dollar figure associated with it. So for the Edwards proposal, what's novel is that it's truly comprehensive and he's willing to commit money to it. So that's the most complete plan. The other two plans are ideas, not sketched out in great detail.
So where does that get us in the fall of 2008, the day after the election, when one of these people, either Democratic or Republican, wins and has to enact this plan?
They have to sketch out these plans a lot more than they have so far for anyone to assess where they might go. Mrs. Clinton's proposal, as I read it last week, basically didn't say much at all about the uninsured, other than hinting that if healthcare were cheaper, more people could be insured. But most of her proposals were things to get better value for the dollar and perhaps to reduce the rapid increase in health spending by using information technology, by cutting out waste, shooting for higher quality. These are not novel ideas. And the real question is, can she get them done any faster than any president has before?
Are the problems and the potential fixes with the healthcare system in this country so widely agreed upon that when we eventually see something from Republican candidates as they proceed in their policymaking, that it might resemble what we're seeing from the Democrats?
They will have to come forth with something. And what they might, and if they're smart, what they'll come forth with is versions of the Massachusetts Arnold Schwarzenegger plan, which is a little bit of everything. You pay off the insurance industry by letting them be the vehicle through which people get third-party coverage. And so I think in many ways the Republicans actually probably have as good a chance as the Democrats of getting something done. Don't ever forget it was Bush, the ultra-conservative, who put in an unbelievably liberal Medicare drug benefit for the elderly that really helped the poor. So I don't think this is really necessarily a Democratic monopoly.
Uwe Reinhardt is a professor of political economy at Princeton University. He covers health and healthcare issues. Professor, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Israel's national electric utility disconnects tens of thousands of people every year because they don't pay their bills. The company doesn't like doing it. It's expensive, not to mention bad PR. So it's found a way to lower the number. It installs prepay meters at the homes of problematic clients. Just like a prepaid calling card, consumers pay for power before they use it. But the solution brought its own problems, as Orly Halpern reports now from Tel Aviv.
Corinne Cohen is a mother of six who survives on Social Security payments. She lives on the edge, buying electricity for her prepaid meter only when she sees she is about to run out.
Let us see how much I have now. Oh, I don't have any credit. I see I am over. I am in debt 10 shekels.
Cohen can get the money to buy more electricity, but her challenge is getting to the electricity company to purchase it. She often doesn't have the $2.50 for the bus, so it takes her an hour by foot.
Look, it tires me a little, this electricity. I wouldn't say it doesn't. It means walking a lot.
Not only are electric companies hard to get to, the hours are inconvenient. They're only open 7:30 to 2:30 and closed Fridays and Saturdays.
In the beginning, I had to always go to the electric company to pay, and there are days that it was closed, and I would get stuck without electricity.
That's Ahmad Abu Zaid, a father of six. Losing electricity at his home puts his children at risk of being hospitalized.
I have two kids sick with asthma who used breathing devices. You understand they must have those devices operating.
And although you can buy more electricity with a phone call and a credit card, most of the poor who have the prepaid meters, like Abu Zaid, don't have checks or credit cards because of bad credit. A solution was found. Sell the electricity at kiosks. Israel Ehrenfreund from the electric company explained why the new program made buying electricity more convenient for the poor.
To enable them to buy electricity on their own budget, on their own time, with a service that's right now going into 24-hour service that allows them to buy the codes for the meter, not only at our offices, but now also at the shops that are open 24 hours, like 7-Eleven in the States or something like that.
Electricity can also be bought at lottery stations and internet cafes. At Chat Center, near Tel Aviv Central Bus Station, business is booming. It's Saturday, and the electricity company is closed. David McCowie has no credit and little electricity left, so he's come to the chat center to buy more.
What did you buy? How
much? 150
shekels.
The teller punches the meter number into the computer and verifies McCowie's name. McCowie hands over 150 shekels, about 40 bucks. He'll go home and punch the code he received into his meter, buying him nearly 2 weeks of electricity.
I have had this meter for a year, and during the last month, I began buying at the kiosk here. It's great.
Although the convenience of buying electricity has improved, the cost of electricity remains high, about 12 cents a kilowatt. Too high for poor families like Abu Zaid's.
They should be considerate of people's economic situation. If there are situations where they can make discounts for people who really need it, so why not do that?
In Tel Aviv, this is Orly Halpern for Marketplace.
Coming up, going green can sound deceptively simple.
It's a matter of replacing a filthy fuel, which is coal, and moving towards a clean resource that is dependable, which geothermal is.
But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, go ahead, take your pick of the encouraging news that helped keep the markets afloat today. New round of takeover deals, improving consumer confidence, or lower oil prices. Which one do you like? Altogether, they gave the Dow a 14-point lift, exactly 0.1% to end the trading day at 13,521. The Nasdaq also gained 14 points, better than 0.5% rise for that index. It closed at 2572. The S&P 500 picked up 2 points, a little more than 0.1% to finish at 1518. Slipping crude prices caused a big slide in the price of oil today and shares. Shares in ConocoPhillips lost nearly 1.5%. ExxonMobil stock also fell more than 1%. Chevron shares lost 0.5%. Bond prices fell. That pushed the yield on the benchmark 10-year T-note up to 4.88%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is scheduled to touch down in Germany for the Group of Eight Foreign Ministers meeting. The price of filling up is on everyone's mind. In Washington, the Independent Petroleum Association of America discusses the rising demand for energy and record-high gasoline prices. And it's National Senior Health and Fitness Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Congress continues with its Memorial Day break, but there's always the phone if lawmakers really need to take care of business. In fact, commentator Jeff Birnbaum says more business than ever is being done by phone.
Everyone knows what earmarks are. They're those special pork barrel projects slipped into legislation that got Republicans in so much trouble the last few years. You remember, the Bridge to Nowhere and the like. Well, now Democrats are in charge in Congress, and earmarks are harder for lawmakers to get, but not impossible. Special interest funding is still available for the clever. Instead of putting pork into legislation, lawmakers are getting around the whole process by phoning their projects in, literally. Eager to avoid the bad publicity of legislative earmarking, lawmakers are secretly calling or writing bureaucrats and demanding that they fund their pet projects by fiat. These projects via telephone, or phone marks, are the hottest new gimmick on the Washington scene. Executive branch officials can dole out millions of dollars with impunity, and they avoid the scrutiny of the public since they are done quietly and without any disclosure. Earmarks actually have to be written down in a public law. Phone marks, on the other hand, are accomplished through bureaucratic sleight of hand, and nobody but the lawmaker and the bureaucrat need to know for sure. So attractive is this backdoor pork barreling that even Harry Reid, the Senate's majority leader, has given it a try. When the House passed a bill funding the Energy Department earlier this year, it boasted that the legislation contained no money earmarked for special projects. But within days, lawmakers, including Reid, began directly contacting the Energy Department, seeking to secure money for their favorite causes. Reid demanded extra money for geothermal energy, a program that his electricity-needy state of Nevada could certainly use. Other lawmakers from both parties flooded the Energy Department with similar requests. And the beautiful part? The money could flow without Congress casting a single vote. Phone marks are the new route to riches at taxpayer expense.
Jeff Birnbaum is a columnist for The Washington Post. Don't phone it in if you want to send us your thoughts. Head to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Here's a statement that on the face of it you'd take to be true. Green power is good for the environment. The response goes a little something like this. Yes, but. Utilities in Southern California are trying to meet the energy needs of a voracious population. The city of Los Angeles, for one, is trying to tap into geothermal and solar sources. The environmental problem comes when those utilities try to get that power to the city's 4 million residents. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner has more.
You might call this a story of conflicting sustainabilities. Los Angeles wants to become the greenest and cleanest city in America, in the words of its mayor. 20% renewable power by 2010. LA can do that partly by tapping into geothermal fields hundreds of miles away in the Southern California desert. Hot water trapped in underground reservoirs is piped to the surface, then spun in turbines to make electricity. David Nahai is president of LA's Water and Power Board.
It's a matter of replacing a filthy fuel, which is coal, and moving towards a clean resource that is dependable, which geothermal is.
But that laudable goal is colliding with another noble endeavor, preserving pristine lands east of an overdeveloped Los Angeles. In order to connect L.A. to that renewable power, the city is planning 85 miles of new power lines and steel transmission towers. But some of the routes under consideration cut through a desert wildlife preserve and skirt the edges of a treasured national park and forest. Environmentalist Chris Elkins says California's high desert may appear desolate.
You have to actually get out and walk it and immerse yourself in it, and you find out very quickly that it is full of life.
This is actually an ecologically sensitive area that's a desert mountain transition zone.
April Saul drives through Pipes Canyon Reserve. She manages the desert area for the nonprofit Wildlands Conservancy. The proposed energy corridor may cut through conservancy land. Saul and other local environmentalists say high-voltage transmission towers here would be like graffiti on art. They worry about the habitat for over 200 kinds of birds and the effect on a hamlet here with a Tinseltown history.
The community of Pioneertown was historically a Western film set. That's how it was founded in 1946. Gene Autry and Annie Oakley and all of the Hollywood folks that came out here to film this area, I think, would be devastated by this proposal.
This kind of debate over environmental trade-offs is going on all over the U.S. Supporters of wind power, for example, weigh the risks to birds and scenic views. Advocates of carbon-free nuclear power must balance that climate benefit with the risks of nuclear waste. Sean Gallagher, director of the Energy Division at the California Public Utilities Commission, says the remote location of many green energy sources is forcing utilities and environmentalists to make uncomfortable decisions.
For example, in California, there are terrific wind resources in the Tehachapi Mountains, not far from Bakersfield, and there are terrific solar resources in the Mojave Desert, but you have to be able to bring the energy into the area where the people live. And that will require either building new transmission or enhancing existing transmission.
Local groups are urging LA to route the so-called Green Path along existing urban power corridors as much as possible, an option that is likely more expensive. LA's David Nahai stresses the city will consider many routes before it makes a final decision.
We have to be protective of our ratepayers as well.
L.A. begins public hearings on its plans this summer. Local conservationists hope they'll hold one of them near Pioneertown, where urban decision makers can take in the high desert views and the solitude their building plans would interrupt. In Pioneertown, California, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Sarah took some pictures while she was out reporting that story for us. You can see the places she visited and learn more about geothermal power at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, you've probably gotten one of those spam emails about wealthy Nigerians with thousands of dollars to invest, only they can't move the money out of the country and they need your help to do it. Most of us just hit delete and chalk it up to another scam, but what if that email contained a plea for help for a puppy who's trapped in Nigeria and needs an owner? Yes, it's true. You heard it here first, folks. The newest scam involves ads and emails showing purebreds on discount. The Council of Better Business Bureaus and the American Kennel Club are issuing a warning today. They advise muzzling the urge to send off any cash. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow moseyed up 14 points, 0.1%. The Nasdaq tagged right along, rising 14 points, 0.5% there. The S&P 500 picked up 2 points as well, 0.1%. Thanks to Miguel Macias and Doug Krisner on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Wendy Sykes. Next time on this program, you know what sushi is, but do you know how it gets to your plate?
Often it's 6, 8, 10 hands have held a piece of fish, and that's across continents, across days, across currencies and time zones.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.